and welcome to We Are History, the most laughable attempt at a podcast on the World Wide Web Net. I'm John O'Farrell, and my partner in crime is...
Hello, I'm Angela Barnes.
TV's Angela Barnes.
TV's Angela Barnes. TV's John O'Farrell.
Once upon a time, grumpy old men. People used to shout, "Oi, grumpy!" out of lorries.
I would, still do, go, John. Not, it was nothing things, you know. To do with the TV
I've
programme.
Books. I've set up a school. I've you know... In musicals, oh, he is grumpy. Listen how grumpy he is. God, he is grumpy.
You're one of the least grumpy people I know, thank John. You. That's thank the you. Funny thing about you.
I was 39 when I was first in that show.
Grumpy old men,
yeah,
and you were 39.
Yeah. I had no idea it was going to be
God,
so big,
is that actually. Show that old?
Yeah, well, thank you for thinking. Yeah, it's 20 years ago.
Well, is it really 20 years old? That in my head, that was sort of in the last 5 years that was on telly.
I know, well, it's endless. It probably was. It's on Dave most nights, I think. But anyway, we're talking about me again. What about you, TV's Angela Barnes? Mock the week.
Yeah, that's it. Just mock the week.
No, you had lots of things. What else are you in, Angela? What else?
What else pops up? World's Greatest Body Shockers on Channel 5. Did that once for the money. That was fun. Although I did refuse. I have a point of pride in that show, John, because I... It was called World's Greatest Body Shockers, and it was all about people with weird piercings and body modification and stuff. And I don't know if you've done these clip shows, but they like sit you in a room, you know, and they just show you a load of clips and you say stuff about them. And then the director showed me a picture of Angelina Jolie's knees, right? And they were a little bit saggy, and she wanted me to comment on that. Like... And I went, "I'm not. That's not body modification. That's just aging.
That's just somebody's."
So I stood my ground on
good
that
for you.
One,
I did one once about punk, and the producer said to me, "Would you say that it had got to, I mean, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but would you say it had got to the point where it was almost like there were no more heroes?" And she wanted me to just do that on camera so they could then cut in "no more heroes." And I just went, it got to the stage where there were no more heroes and something better changed, and everyone was pretty vacant, and teenage kids were hard to get. And they didn't use it. But then I saw another second-rate celeb like me saying exactly like, and it was almost saying completely sincerely, it was almost like we got to the point where there were no more heroes.
No more heroes.
Okay, she got someone to do it.
Oh, God. I needed the money, John. I was young and needed the money.
So we're chatting away. We haven't introduced. We're talking about show business today.
Oh, yeah.
This week's podcast is about show business. Angela has selected this subject, and we are going way back in time.
Well, John, I thought, you know, you're a bit of an old thesp, aren't you?
I have trodden the boards. I have. Yes. Given
child actor.
That's the reason that Angela's chosen this one. So she can take the piss out of me for being a child actor.
100%. I love the idea of you as a child actor, John. I love that you were in a film with Diana Dawes.
I'm going to send you a picture now of me as a child actor. So we have live on.
Oh, we'll tweet this out, won't we? Let me see. Oh, look at you. That's it. Those socks, John. They are something else. Who was playing Winnie the Pooh?
A guy called Ronald Rad, who we don't really remember very much.
I have to say, right?
Yeah.
I've got a photo somewhere, and I will try and dig it out, of me dressed as Winnie the Pooh for a thing at school.
We could have been a double act.
A school play. We could have been a double act, but also my costume was way better than this guy's. Way better. The one my mum made was way better than his.
I'm sending you another one now, and this is me in the horror movie From Beyond the Grave.
John, you look like you're in a boy band.
Oh, thank you. I'll take that as a compliment.
Well, you are. So how old were you there?
I was 11 there.
Those collars.
Yeah, it was filmed at Shepperton. I got a chauffeur-driven Bentley, pick me up every day from home and take me to Shepperton Studios. Diana Dawes was my mum. Ian Bannon was my dad. I killed them both with voodoo.
What was the film called?
It's called From Beyond the Grave. And I wasn't allowed to see it because it was an X. It was an 18. But if you see that film now, Diana Dawes is this like working class mum. And I made this very interesting acting choice of being a posh kid from Maidenhead. Very interesting. The accent I chose for that was like, "Chap at school says he knows a man who sells matches by the station and he has a Rolls Royce." That's basically how I talk.
That's how all kids talk though when they are acting in the 70s, right? What I'm always interested in with child actors is, because there's a lot of controversy. Obviously now, like, you have to have a license, you have to be well chaperoned.
Yeah,
how chaperoned. Much were you protected from the fact it was a horror film?
You had to have a chaperone. You had to have, I was, my mum was my chaperone on that one.
Mm.
But when I was in TV shows or when we did West End stuff, I always had a chaperone with me, and they were sort of, they were sort of basically your right-hand person.
And were you sort of protected from the theme of the film if it was a horror? Were you sort
No, because we were on set. Nobody told me they were going to put this great big gash across my dad's head and he was going to fall across the wedding cake. I mean, probably if I'd read the script, I might have known that. But, you know, it was a voodoo theme and there was a murder and stuff. And they came and put teardrops in my eyes and I had to pretend to cry that my mum had been killed and stuff, even though I'd done it.
God, I very can't believe I haven't watched this yet. I'm going to watch that tonight.
From Beyond the Grave. It's a portmanteau film. So, I mean, like one of the stories. So it's like four stories. If you see the one with Diana Dawes, I think it might be the second one. That's the one with me. But yeah, a very moving performance from young John O'Farrell, which is why he went on to be such a major movie star and, you know, and West End leading man.
So it was because of your child actor credentials, John, that I chose this. Well, I sort of stumbled across this story because I'm a nerd. I was just reading a history magazine.
As you do.
As you do. And I came across this story and I thought, oh, I want to do that because of John's background. But also it was something I had no idea about. So I'm going to take you back. It is 1600.
Yes.
It is still pretty early days of the English Protestant Reformation. Queen Elizabeth, is Elizabeth I, obviously. I know our queen's been there a while, but not that long.
Yeah, she's towards the end of her reign, isn't it? Towards the end of her last days of Queen Elizabeth.
That's right. So she's been on the throne since 1558, which whenever I say that she's been on the throne since 1558, I want to say she must have piles or something, but I've said it now.
Let's raise the tone, anyway. Angela. Let's try and talk about theatre now, darling.
William Shakespeare's at the height of his fame. The Globe Theatre had opened a year previously in 1599 by his company, the Lord Chamberlain's Men.
Indeed.
So theatre's popular in London at this point. It's a popular pastime for the masses. And two of the Globe shareholders were the Burbage brothers. You might have heard of Richard Burbage, was the actor. But there was Charles and Cuthbert and their father, James Burbage. So there's this Burbage dynasty in the theatre. And they bought another theatre called the Blackfriars Theatre, which was, Blackfriars at the time was a very sort of posh, well-to-do part of London.
Okay. Not south of the river like the Globe.
Not south of the river like the Dirty Globe. And their theatre, Blackfriars Theatre, was a bit different to the Globe because it was undercover, whereas the Globe was open air.
The Elements, right. So they had candlelight and stuff,
Yeah. Now, theatre in those days, John, in the Elizabethan period, a little bit different to the sort of middle-class pursuit it is today. We've all seen...
I'm middle-class, so I go to the National.
Yes, darling, I am. It was a lot more rowdy, you know, working classes would go to the theatre. They were encouraged to join in a bit. You know, they would throw things, they would misbehave. All sorts of vice went on at the theatre, John.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed to me that it was all classes, actually, because you had the posh people as well would pay to sit on the stage and sort of pose and sort of ad lib and stuff. So you had the sort of cheap seats with everyone, well, cheap seats, the standing. And then you had places where, but it was also a place to be seen if you were a bit of a dandy and a bit of a show off.
Oh, absolutely. And what you said about sitting on the stage, that's the thing now we can't get our heads around, but you would, like the most expensive tickets, you would sit on the stage with the players and you would talk to them. You would interrupt the flow of the play. You would join in.
When you're doing your stand-up, it's bad enough with a heckler.
Right.
Imagine if they were like, I'm just going to sit next to Angela while she's doing her gig and say unfunny things and I've paid for the right to do it.
Just speak to her before the punchline. I love it when that happens, John. Well, we're just coming up to the punchline and someone says something inane from the audience. It's
exactly
really,
right.
It's the best thing.
Oh, God. I mean, can you imagine if you were the writer sitting in the audience? So, I mean, we had our Shakespeare musical that we did in New York and there's this one joke which goes, they got this this money from this guy and he's going, you can't have this guy as a patron. It's illegal. He goes, he's not a patron. He's producing money for the production to get it produced. So we call him, well, we haven't got a name for it yet. And he goes, he's producing money for the production to get it produced. And this woman in the front row goes, a producer. It's like, shut up.
I love it. Who is it? I think I'm going to do a name drop here. I'm pretty sure it was Jason Manford who told me this story, but I might be wrong. But about going, they went to see Billy Joel, right? And Billy Joel's playing all his hits and stuff. And he's doing his encore. And he hasn't done Piano Man yet.
Right.
So they're like, okay, that's obviously good. And apparently the encore, like the lights had all gone off. The lights come back on. And there's just a piano in the middle of the room with a light shining on it, right? It's pretty obvious what's coming next. And someone from the crowd just shouts out, do Piano Man. It's like, as if that's not what was about to happen.
Oh, he picked up on the hints. What could it
mean?
Yeah,
well done. Aren't you clever?
Oh, God. So children actors. Tell us about children actors in Elizabethan theatre.
So one of the things we know, I think, about Elizabeth, it was fairly well known, is that women weren't allowed to perform in Elizabethan theatre in Shakespeare's time. The parts of women were often played by sort of slightly more effeminate men or boys whose voices had not yet broken. But what's less well known is there was a bit of a fashion around this time in the early 1600s for boys' companies. Right. So entire theatre companies made of
young
boys whose voices hadn't broken. And Elizabeth I, she loved them.
Wow.
Right? She loved boys' companies. And they would often perform at court. And they sort of grew out of companies of choristers. So there was several courtly choirs. So you'd have the Chapel Royal Choir and St. Paul's Choir that would perform at court. And it all started by they would also do these little religious plays that the boy choristers would do. And Queen Elizabeth was quite famous for, she loved a bit of elaborate entertainment.
Yes.
Right? Her court went down in history for that. She loved spectacles, pageants, masks, acrobatics, a little bit of bear baiting.
Love a bit of bear baiting.
Love a bit. I'd watch the Royal Variety performance if it was Jason Manford hosting bear baiting from the Palladium. And they'd go on for weeks, these shows, like weeks. And the court would become like a luxury hotel. And it was just a big old to-do.
Josh, to interrupt you there, but just one of the research I did about this period is that there was a competition for the use of the theatres. And the people who owned the theatres were like, well, you could put your play on Shakespeare, mate, but if I put bear baiting on, I'm going to get more bigger crowd in. So a bear being ripped apart by dogs or Hamlet, you know, I've got to make a financial decision there.
That's it. And now, of course, the sort of modern equivalent of that is, I could put on your play that no one's seen, or I could put on this ABBA tribute band.
Exactly.
That will play to sold out houses
Friends of mine were setting up a theatre company. And when they were starting out, they were playing, you know, it would be the Arts and Leisure Centre in Kidlington or whatever. And he'd have to make a choice between, well, are you going to get an audience? Because I could have half the leisure centre, your play, and let the badminton courts carry on next to you. have the rock climbing. The rock climbers normally are Tuesday nights. So if you're booked for Tuesday nights, if you're not getting an audience, I'm letting the rock climbers in. And this was things that used to happen to them. They'd have the badminton happening whilst they were performing. Sorry, do continue, Angela.
Yeah, so Queen Elizabeth loved having these big shows. It must have been quite... Well, obviously, it must be quite frightening to perform for Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah.
But then I think it's mainly because I base everything I know about Queen Elizabeth on Miranda Richardson's portrayal in Blackadder.
You've done your history research, Angela. You've watched Blackadder. That's good enough for me.
She really loved the boy companies.
Right.
So the entertainment at court often involved young boys, be it in the form of choristers from St. Paul's or Chapel Royal.
Yeah.
They do these little religious plays. And she loved them so much that there were more child actors that performed for her court than adult actors.
Wow.
Now, in the commercial theatre at this time, theatre's moving away from the church, right? It'd always been, you know, theatre sort of grew up from religious plays.
Well, I suppose the Catholic Church was very showy and very sort of glittering costumes. And there was a move against the all the artifice and the incense and the glittery show business of the Catholic Church, so that maybe they had to separate those two out a bit.
Exactly. We're talking sort of in the half a century after the Reformation and the Puritans were taking hold, you know, and of course you can listen to what happened next with that on our podcast about Oliver Cromwell. So theatre becomes this lucrative commercial venture, and there was loads of money to be made in theatre because there was nothing else to do, John. No Netflix. What are you going to do?
No public sport, of course. No sort of football matches.
No football matches. No.
So crowds gathering and going ooh and ah at the Globe and the Swan or the Rose Theatre. These were, you know, watch the movie Shakespeare in Love. It's a great reminder of what it was like back then.
So these boys that performed, you know, these religious plays and choirs and stuff, the theatre companies liked them because they were very skilled at arousing sort of pathos and emotion with these unbroken sweet voices that they had. So they appealed to these secular sort of commercial theatre companies as well. And also, of course, John, with boys, you don't have to pay them.
Oh, no. Same with the lad who does my chimney.
Yeah, see? There you go. So Shakespeare, for example, his companies did use boy actors. The sort of more mainstream companies did use them, but they had them on a sort of apprentice basis, like the guilds would have apprentices. So you would be assigned a master actor and you would learn from him, and then eventually you would become an adult actor if you made the grade.
Wasn't all as nice as that, was it?
It wasn't. So let's go back to this Blackfriars Theatre, right, that the Burbages owned. The intention was that the Lord Chamberlain's Men, Shakespeare's company, would play at the Blackfriars Theatre. It'd be a nice winter venue. But the well-to-do locals decided it's all very well to have the theatre down on the South Bank, but they didn't want it on that. Not in my backyard, John. Right.
NIMBYs they were.
The NIMBYs, because it was in a posh neighbourhood and the locals thought, well, they don't want these companies of rowdy, destructive actors, you know, coming and getting drunk and messing up the place, you know. So the Burbages were forbidden for using the venue for commercial theatre in that way. Step forward, Henry Evans.
Oh, tell me about him.
Henry Evans, pretty ruthless, money-grabbing theatre impresario. Not really interested in theatre as an art form, more how he can make money out of it. Sort of Lloyd Webber of his day.
That's a and very that's harsh mean, slur isn't it? On Sir Andrew.
It's me. Maybe Bill Kenwright. I don't know. Maybe
wonderful theatre-lovey people.
Cameron
all
McIntosh.
In my
I don't know. One of them. One of them. I know you can't slag any of them off because you write musicals.
I'm basically going to be needing these guys for a theatre at some point. So
exactly. So I said all that.
I'm backing up this lane. I'm reverting fast.
So what Henry Evans does, right, he's a businessman, essentially, first.
Yep.
So he leases the theatre at Blackfriars from the Burbages.
Right.
And he sets it up as a boys' company. Now, okay. The locals are all right with this because boys don't drink or womanise, okay. Right? And they had a bit of class.
Okay.
And the plays they staged at Blackfriars Theatre weren't billed as anything as vulgar as a commercial play. They sold tickets, but they were sold as if they were coming to watch a rehearsal for a private show with these young
boys. I've got a bad feeling about
this,
Angela.
Right. Oh, John, Henry Evans goes into partnership with a man called Nathan Giles.
Right.
Now, there's a good reason he's chosen Nathan Giles to go into partnership. Because what does a boy company need, John?
Boys, miss.
Needs boys, right? And Giles, Nathan Giles, he was the master of the boy choristers at the Chapel Royal. So he has access to boys. So it might be worth mentioning at this point a little bit about childhood in Elizabethan
times.
Yeah, it was a bit different. It wasn't, you know, there were no such thing as children's rights. A third of the population of London were under 15.
Wow.
And they were put to work from the age of seven, you were put to work, right? Or you were, you joined a band of vagrants and pickpockets and worked the streets or whatever. This is if you're, you know, not
down at the posh. Lower end of the scale. So there's
no
the
lower
sense
end of scale.
I mean,
so only the richest boys were educated, were sent to school.
Right. And so kids grew up very fast. They were like, there's no, yep. You weren't hidden or protected. There was no sort of like, you know, oh, you're going to be all right with a babysitter, darling. It was like, get out there and work and, you know, all the ugly side of life where you're exposed to all of it.
Yeah. You were just a smaller version of an adult.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
There was no protecting them from, you know, protecting their innocence or any of that stuff. And so a lot of what I'm about to say sounds pretty terrible, and it was pretty terrible, but also at the time, I mean, this is a culture which sort of glorified violence.
Yes.
Way more than we do now. You know, public executions and things, you know, children would watch those.
Witch burnings, bear baiting, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so it's a different time, John, is what I'm
different
saying.
Time. Sort of
it's
running
all
through
a different
our
time.
Podcast, isn't it, really? Different time. It sort of keeps coming up, this.
If we got a pound for every time we mentioned a different time, we might make some money in this podcast.
That's right.
Be nice, wouldn't it? So, what I hadn't realised until I started reading more about this is there'd been a long-standing tradition of using impressment to recruit choristers. Now, impressment, you've probably heard of it mostly in a military context, right?
Oh, for the Navy and that, press gangs.
Forced recruitment of labour, basically.
Right.
So these
kids were press ganged into the choirs.
They were press ganged into choirs for cathedrals and the court
That's
chapels.
Insane.
So the most prestigious choirs, the
right.
choir masters would be given a royal warrant
right.
to impress children.
So don't walk down a dark lane with a fluffy white ruff and a red cloak singing Ave Maria, because they're going to get you. It's like,
yeah. Well, they could go into schools, institutions, churches, whatever, and impress the best singers, the best boys for their choirs. So their families had no say in it. It was completely legal, which is, it's hard for us to get our head around. But actually, for many families, it was seen as a privilege if your child was press ganged into the Royal Chapel choir.
Right. So it wasn't always violent. It might be like,
it wasn't
we want
always,
that kid
oh, no,
there.
No.
We want that kid there, and they were like, oh, that's a good opportunity for you, Jasper. You could go and be in the choir. Or exactly. Sometimes it was violent yourself.
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes for the families, it was a financial relief. You know, right. That was one less mouth for them to have to feed if they were going to be taken care of by the Chapel Royal. And it meant the boys were getting an education, which they might not have got. Some of the boys that were impressed, you know, they would potentially have a job. And to sing for God and Queen was a big honour, right, in this religious society where childhood isn't childhood. So these children were trafficked about, like, pawns, and it's likely they weren't treated particularly well. There's some reports of them being chained up or, you know, but that's just how it was. Now, Henry Evans knew that Nathan Giles had this warrant where he was allowed to impress children for the chapel choir. So he thought, if I go into business with him, that warrant means I can impress children for the boys' theatre company.
Oh, that's dodgy.
Right. Now, the warrant was about choirs. Yeah.
He's allowed to get them for the choir so I can get them for my funny show.
For my commercial venture that's nothing to do with the church.
Right.
Right. And that's what he did. They went into partner together and they used his warrant as a way to impress children, take them from their families.
Yeah.
And say, it's legal. You've got no
comeback.
No way of challenging this. Yeah.
I would say, as auditions go, Angela. It's not the worst. Yep. I mean, you know, we've both been in show business. You must have had some auditions worse than being bashed over the head in the street.
Oh, my God. There's some auditions where I think I'd much rather they just kidnapped me from the street and gave me the job. Definitely.
When I was a child, Angela, I had to go out on this rickety old stage and I had this song I'd sing. There'd be some old bloke with a fag out of his mouth at the piano. And what's your name, dear? John O'Farrell. What are you going to sing for us, John? Going to sing Little Boy Fishing. And they go plinky plonk plink. And I go, Little Boy Fishing off a wooden pier. Come fish, swim along here. Pathetically, I still remember my audition song for Winnie the Pooh.
That's so adorable.
So when I was, my first words on stage, I had to go on, I was just a 1,000-seater Phoenix Theatre in the West End of London. Spotlight, I walk on in my shorts, as you've seen for the picture, which we're going to tweet out. And my first words were, I had to sing, wherever I go, there's always poo.
Always poo.
There's always poo and me. And that's sort of been the theme of my career, really.
I had to read that at a friend's wedding.
That poem. Wow. I could have given you a tune to say it to.
A reading. And wherever I go, there's always poo is the first line. Yeah. And I just got, it was a church wedding. She was getting up. And that's the first, you can see people looking at me and then they're like, the relief when it's
an H. She's got an H. She's better red.
I see where she's going with this now.
Yes.
Wherever I go, there's always poo and me.
But I wasn't press ganged. I was taken by my mum to the audition. And there was no.
So your mum press ganged.
There were a few mums there who were like press ganging their own children into theatre. I will say that. So what happened then when these kids got.
So, well, it was a win-win situation for Henry Evans here because he either got this free boy labour.
Yeah.
Or the parents would bribe him not to take their children into the theatre and he would have revenue from the bribes.
Right, that sounds like nothing can go wrong.
They would target educated boys from wealthier families, A, because they had money to bribe them not to do it,
yeah,
and B, because at this time the boys would have been, so these are, you know, educated middle class, upper class boys, they would be taught Latin at school and they would also be taught voice. Voice was really important part of education then, like reading, writing and speaking.
Okay.
Oratory was really important. So they would have nice voices. They would be taught how to speak iambic verse. So their parents would either have to suck it up and let their boy go to the theatre or they could afford to pay a bribe to get their son back. But one day, John, one day they kidnapped the wrong boy.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun. So it's 13th of December. 1600, little Thomas Clifton. He was 13 years old and he was making his way to Christ Church School, which was half a mile away from where he lived. So it's just a half a mile walk.
Cheese and onion quavers, bottle of pop.
Cheese and onion, that's right. And he was the only son of a good family, right? And he attended grammar school, as all posh people do, John, including me.
Comprehensive boy, me. We didn't have grammar schools in Berkshire.
I tell you what, if you ask people which one of us went to a grammar school and which one was comprehensive educated, they would get that wrong, wouldn't they? But I just have to say, my school was a state school.
I know, of course it was. It was Kent. They've still got Kent. Bloody grammar schools in Kent.
Still got grammar schools in Kent, yep. So,
Out of nowhere,
a man appears and violently seizes the boy and drags him away.
Wow, right? Showbiz.
Showbiz. So, why has he been kidnapped? Well, the Blackfriars Theatre's boys' company, Henry Evans' company, has an important gig coming up.
Well, right? Fair enough.
They are going to be performing to Queen Elizabeth I at court. And the play they're performing is a Ben Jonson play, not the runner who got done for drugs in the 1988 Olympics, but the playwright. His satirical comedy, Cynthia's Revels.
Oh, yeah, about her sweets. And, yeah, she had a whole bag of Revels, Cynthia.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. She didn't like the coffee ones. That's the, yeah. And the play was especially written for the boys' company. Ben Jonson was very involved with the company. In fact, when one of the boys died at age 13, he wrote the eulogy for him. Salomon Pavey, the boy's name was. Anyway. One theory of why he worked with the boys' company so much is that it was much easier to hide sort of subversive ideas in plain sight in a way that he couldn't with adults.
If you've got a sort of satirical line or a barbed comment, if the child doesn't understand what they're saying, it's a much more innocent face.
Exactly. Sort of, and they're not like sort of, you know, giving a big old theatrical wink at the
that's clever.
Courtiers as they're saying it, you know. And just their inherent innocence meant he could get away with saying things that weren't very innocent. So they had this gig coming up. They were doing this Ben Jonson play for the Queen, and they needed boys who were good enough. There's not many records about what happened to Thomas Clifton. They don't seem to be any records that say why they chose him off the street, whether they had previous knowledge of him, whether he just looked right, and so they plucked him off the street or what. We don't really know. What we do know is he was taken to Blackfriars Theatre. He was given a script and was told that he'd be whipped if he didn't learn it, right?
Got to motivate the kids.
Just walking to school, minding his own business. Next thing he knows, he's been scooped up, taken to a theatre, told to learn a script or else.
Or get whipped.
Now, his father, Henry Clifton, obviously his son's not come home from school.
Yeah.
So he's worried. And again, we don't know how he knew where he'd been taken.
Those lovey kidnappers.
Exactly. Those famous lovey kidnappers. So he went to the theatre to get his son back. But Evans and Giles, what did they have, John?
They've got the warrant.
Got the legal royal warrant.
They've got the law on their side. They're allowed to do this because he's a chorister press ganger.
Right. So Henry Clifton has to just go home without his son.
So his wife goes, did you pick up our boy who's been kidnapped? Oh, I couldn't because, he had this bit of paper. And
Exactly.
You what? Go and get the son. No, I can't because he said he's chorister.
It's got a royal warrant. The Queen signed it and everything. What can I do?
Oh, my God.
So we'll take a little break here while John practices iambic verse for an audition you got this afternoon, haven't you, John?
That's right. I've got a sonnet I want to read to you. So
lovely.
We'll find out what happened to little Thomas. I'm worried.
Little Thomas Clifton.
Little Thomas Clifton. And we'll come back after this break.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to the second half. We're talking about children in the theatre in Elizabethan England and the kidnap of Thomas Clifton. Angela, what was your first time on stage as a child?
Oh, I can tell you this. My first time on stage was in The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Oh, wow. Were you Mickey Mouse?
No, I played the bottom half of a broomstick.
You weren't even a whole broomstick.
No, because the broomstick splits in two, right, in The Sorcerer's Apprentice. But I remember I was the bottom half and Philip Butler was the top half.
Yeah.
And he was really jealous because I got the bristles.
Oh, yeah.
He was just a stick.
Yeah, yeah. You gave Maidstone School your Sidcup School or whatever.
I gave Eastborough County Primary School my finest bristle. Half a broomstick. And I played Winnie the Pooh.
Did you play Winnie the Pooh?
It was the story where he eats all the honey and gets stuck in the
rabbits. Going to see rabbit
hole
story. Yeah, we had that.
Yeah, and I had to be pulled out of the rabbit hole. I remember playing Pandora in Pandora's Box.
Wow.
And Ian Russell played my husband, who had to pretend to slap me, and he didn't pretend on the night.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, gave me a right slap across the chops.
Oh my God.
I did quite a lot of drama in secondary school and. Played Benjamin the donkey in Animal Farm.
Oh, okay. So I went off and did drama at university, and it was all bloody standing around in black polo neck, black leotards, pretending to be a
tree.
Yeah, it was sort of, you know, be the nuclear winter, you know, not gags that I was really sort of designed for.
Yeah.
When I was Christopher Robin, a young Wayne Sleep was Tigger.
Oh, really?
He did fantastic dancing, and we had the guy from Are You Being Served was Eeyore, Captain Peacock.
Oh, wow.
I remember once coming out of theatre with my mum, and there's a couple going, what time does the show start? To each other. 3 o'clock. My mum goes, oh, I do hope you enjoy it. Oh, are you going to see it as well? No, my son's in it, actually. And I said, oh, we're going to see Wind in the Willows up the road. And they won't even go to our show.
You had a proper stage mum, John. I love it.
Yeah. Lots of very pushy parents when I was a child actor, but no child was actually bashed over the head with a truncheon and a sack over the head and dragged to be at, dragged into the Red Roofs Theatre School where I went. So what happened to Thomas Clifton then? What's he been kidnapped?
So he's been snatched off the streets. His father, Henry, is concerned for his son's welfare. And it's suggested in quite a few things that I've read that he wasn't so much concerned about his son's welfare as he was for the sort of how it looked in a family to have a son go into the theatre.
Bloody snobs.
Because they were a well-to-do family, and he was the only son, so the only son and heir.
Yeah.
So his life, Thomas Clifton, was pretty mapped out for him. You know, he's going to go to school, become a lawyer or some other professional, and it wasn't in his father's plans for his only son to, well, say run away and join the theatre,
to be
press-ganged into the theatre. And it wasn't, you know, while people enjoyed going to the theatre, the actor's life wasn't one that you aspired to if you were a well-to-do person. It was seen as a sort of drunken, debauched, I mean, sounds great.
Sounds good.
And also, while this boys' company was seen as being particularly subversive, you know, while you had Shakespeare that was doing stuff that appealed to the masses, a bit more broader appeal, all this political and satirical stuff the boys' company were doing, you know, if you were a well-to-do family with friends in high places, you probably didn't want your kids involved in that for your own reputation, you know.
The thing I would say about all of this, I think there seems to be something very dodgy at the heart of all this, that people were very attracted to the idea of young boys performing adult parts on stage, dressing as women on stage, and they found it very erotically charged, I would say, to see young prepubescent boys acting out adult themes. Would that be a fair comment?
Yeah. I mean, there's few records, but it's sort of suggested that there's a potential that these boys were exploited not only on stage, but off stage as well. I mean, the boys were sort of between 10 and 13, 14 years old. At this time, the one thing to remember is, you know, boys could get married at 14, girls at 12. So that it was a very, again, different time. However, that doesn't make the kidnapping of boys from the street, you know, with the likely potential they were sexually exploited, any more palatable, really.
No.
But, you know, especially to our sort of modern...
Well, I'm not sure at the time, if you were kidnapped and sexually exploited at the age of 12, you go, yeah, but we could do that at the moment because it's different times. I was at different times. That's fine.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like, oh, that made it okay.
Yeah.
You know, and we don't really know what happened to those boys, but the suggestion is because those parts were written... You know, the parts that were written as women were written for boys playing women.
Yeah,
they were written that way.
Weird,
they were written
it?
To be very erotically charged and very sexual, you know,
pretty
for these young boys
though, isn't
to
it?
Play.
If you think about sort of Portia in Merchant of Venice, so it would have been a man, a boy, playing a woman who then disguises herself as a man to go to court. Right. It's like to play, you know, Balthazar. It's like...
Or very meta. Well, I mean, Shakespeare himself was not a fan of the boy companies.
Really good old Shakespeare.
Well, I don't think it was a moral objection so much as probably a financial one, because they were taking a lot of his business because they were so popular.
People would rather see the boys dressed up as ladies than his,
Absolutely. They were a bit more fun than watching Henry
V.
So how
do we know? Did he refer
to
it?
Well, he does make a little dig at them. In Hamlet.
Oh, yes.
So in Act 2, Scene 2 of Hamlet, there's a troupe of travelling players visiting Hamlet in Denmark. And they're there because the popularity of the boy companies in London has forced them out of London. Right? So they have to travel Europe instead.
Right.
So that's one little comment. Or, you know, the whole fact they're there is because these boy companies have... And Rosencrantz sort of has a sneer about them. And the line is, John, it's very witty. The line is... There is, sir, an airy of children, little Iases, an Ias is an untrained hawk, little Iases that cry out on top of the question. No, the oh, cry out the, on the top of us. So you can tell I fucked it up. Hang on, let me try again. There is, sir, an area of children, little irises, that's untrained hawks, right, that cry out on the top of question and are most tyrannically clapped for it. Apparently that's very witty. That's very
good. That's very good, Angela.
I mean, I wouldn't open with it, John, but, you know.
I had to find a joke for our Shakespearean musical, a Shakespearean joke. So I opened Romeo and Juliet, which is the play they were talking about at the time. And on page one of Romeo and Juliet, it goes, "No, we could not carry coals, for then we would be colliers." It's like, oh, that's brilliant, Will. That's such a great joke, mate.
We could not carry
coals, because then we'd be colliers. It's like... Shakespearean comedies are not funny, Angela. I'm going to go out on a limb here.
Yeah, I'm with you, John. I'm with you. And the fact that you have to work, they go, no, no, if you read the subtext, you go, well, if I have to work hard, then it's not a joke.
You should have footnotes for your...
If I have to do the background reading to get it, then
try
that's
that on
a failure.
You wouldn't last very
exactly.
long.
Exactly.
You go forward 60 years, dare I say it, but some of the restoration comedies in King Charles II's time, they are quite funny. So it's weird how our humour sort of evolves over that century. But Shakespearean comedy,
I wonder if,
I'm not
a reaction to that Puritanism maybe is to just,
Anyway, this joke aside, it shows that Shakespeare disapproved.
Yeah. I said earlier that Henry Evans and Nathan Giles have picked the wrong boy when they kidnapped Thomas Clifton. And this is why. Because Henry Clifton, turns out, had friends in high places. And one of those friends was a man called Sir John Fostercue. Now, there's no record particularly in why Sir John Fostercue decided to help him. But he had previously been master of the revels, whose job it would have been was basically a censorship job, you know, would have said who was allowed to perform in theatres and what was licensed and what wasn't, etc. But he was now at this point, he was the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Right. So big deal. And he agreed to help Henry get his son back. So he gave him a release warrant.
OK, a legal document. Right?
A legal document. So the next day, Henry Clifton was able to go back to Blackfriars Theatre and slap that down on the table and go, right, I see your impressment warrant and I raise you a release warrant. Give me my son back.
And so that was enough.
And that's what he did.
Right, okay.
So they had no legal reason to keep Thomas Clifton anymore and he took his son away, leaving all the other boys there,
of course.
His son was fine, but the other boys were all still left to their fate. But he didn't leave it there, Henry Clifton. He decided, no, I want retribution for this. I want to build a case against
Henry
Evans.
Well, you would be knocked, wouldn't you? You'd be annoyed.
You would be, yeah. So for the best part of a year, Henry Clifton starts collecting evidence against what was going on at Blackfriars Theatre. Now, Henry Evans got wind of this, we assume, because he started sort of in a panic signing over all his belongings to his son-in-law.
Never the action of an innocent man.
Absolutely. So it's like if he was taken to court, you know, they couldn't take away what wasn't his.
Yeah, his son-in-law's got it all, yeah.
Exactly. So the only possession he didn't sign over was the lease of the theatre. Also, at this point, we're now in 1601, Queen Elizabeth has started to clamp down on the misuse of these warrants that she'd signed. So she was starting to become aware that these royal warrants for impressment for children for choirs were being misused. And in fact, in her famous golden speech to Parliament in November 1601, she mentioned the abuses of power that she'd given to these people. So
the game was up. Because I don't mind you banging people over the head to be in the choir, but not to be in children's...
Not to be filthy actors.
Not into Children's Film Foundation stuff.
Exactly. So 15th of December 1601, Henry Clifton's bill of complaint was filed at the Star Chamber.
Star Chamber, that sounds good. It sounds like an ITV show.
It sounds like a shit entertainment agency, doesn't it? The Star Chamber is where they book cruise singers, but it isn't. The Star Chamber is the highest court of the land at the time. His complaint doesn't hold back. He explains what Evans and Giles have been doing. He accuses them of, and I quote, taking children for their own corrupt gain and lucre to furnish and maintain a playhouse in the Blackfriars.
It's not fair enough.
Which is exactly what they were doing. Yeah. And he described his son's kidnap. He said, they kidnapped him with great force and violence. Did they seize and surprise the said Thomas Clifton and did haul, drag and carry him away to the said playhouse?
Wow.
And wasn't mucking about.
Yeah. Didn't he also say that the boys were in no way fit for singing? Like this was that's the point.
Well, this was the legal point that he, because they did have an impressment warrant, right? So his legal point was you have an impressment warrant for choir boys. However, he basically said, and this is what won him the case, my son Thomas can't sing.
Oh, that's the point, isn't it? I mean, it's
and
like
that's a bit of a flaw in a choir.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't mind you bashing kids over their head and dragging them away, but when they're crap singers, that's going too far.
Exactly. So you did think, like, poor Thomas Clifton, yeah. Mark, but all right, Dad. I mean, thanks for rescuing me in that, but did you tell her, have to tell everyone that I'm shit at singing?
But that was the legal point that won him the day.
That was the legal point, because his son had been impressed for acting and not singing, and therefore that warrant wasn't legal. Now, there's no records of the actual hearing of the case, don't survive, but we know it took place in 1602, and records from 10 years later talk about it, and they divulge that Henry Clifton won. Evans was found guilty. Henry Evans was found guilty. He was fined £100.
Wow,
which
that's
in
a lot.
Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands in those days. And the wording of the final verdict, it read, Henry Evans was censured, so found to be at fault for his unorderly carriage and behaviour in taking up gentlemen's children against their will.
Gentlemen's children.
Well, this is the interesting thing, isn't it? It's sort of not the kidnapping of children per se.
Yeah, no,
it's the kidnapping of
the
gentlemen's
children. Not the
children.
Posh kids. Not kids. Yeah. You can't pick up kids who would say things like, chap at school says he knows a man who sells matches by the station, but he has a Rolls Royce. You can have the Cockney kids. But not the little Jono Farrell.
Not the Cockney kids, that's
not
fine.
The kids from Wedworth's Theatre School.
I'm Rob Hutton, and I grew up watching war movies with my dad. But my kids just don't get it. So I had to find someone to watch them with me.
And that's me, Duncan Weldon. And I do get it. So I was only too happy to join Rob and guests such as Al Murray, Helen Lewis, and Satin Sangara as we rewatch the greatest war movies of all time.
So join us on War Movie Theatre to talk about classics from Where Eagles Dare to Zulu to The Sound of Music.
That's War Movie Theatre, wherever you get your podcasts.
So Henry Evans was punished for taking Thomas Clifton, but he wasn't ordered to return any of the other impressed children. They were all allowed to stay. At this point, after the court case, Nathan Giles, the guy who held the warrant, disassociated himself with Evans. Because he wanted to keep his warrant for the choir. And in fact, when his warrant was up for renewal, so it was reissued in 1606, and it was amended, the wording, to read, none shall be used as comedians or stage players, for it is not fit or decent.
Absolutely bloody comedians.
So exactly. So they specified on his warrant, this is just for choir boys now.
Lowest of the low, those comedians are.
Absolutely. But you know, like the practice of choral impressment lasted another 100 years. It lasted to the mid-18th century. It's mad, isn't it?
That is crazy. So Queen Elizabeth is dead by 1606. Of course, she died in 1603. Really? James I, the Scottish king, James VI of Scotland, comes south.
Yep. And this is the beginning of the end, really, for the boys' theatres.
Is it?
Firstly, because it was Queen Elizabeth who was a big fan of the boys' theatres.
Yeah.
But also, James I was seen in London as a bit of an outsider, right? He's from Scotland. And he was far more politically sensitive than Elizabeth had been.
Less secure, I suppose, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And the playwrights, they continued to write increasingly satirical plays for these boy actors. And they were critiquing the customs of the court, and they would use stereotypes to mock the Scots, which would never happen today. You'd never happen today. You'd never talk about deep fried food.
No, deep fried Mars bars was not a thing back then. They would make a cliche joke like that.
Absolutely.
In fact, Shakespeare, to his credit, he wrote Macbeth because everything Scottish was fashionable. And he made Banquo innocent of the murder of Macduff. Not Macduff, who's the king? Duncan. Duncan gets killed.
Duncan,
In history, it's the fault of Macbeth and Banquo. But because James I was a direct descendant of Banquo, he exonerates Banquo of any guilt in that. That's my little A-level fact for you of Macbeth.
Yeah, what an arse-lick.
He was an arse-lick.
He was an arse-lick, Shakespeare. There we are, you heard it first. Shakespeare, nothing but an arse-lick. So the king wasn't amused, and he really clamped down on the playwrights that were offending him. Ben Jonson, who wrote specifically for the boys, his play Eastward Ho was so peppered with sort of anti-Scottish references that it landed him in prison.
That's worse than a bad review, isn't it? You're actually a play so bad, you're going to prison.
It's like so bad. In 1608, there was a play in which a king himself was portrayed as this sort of foul-mouthed drunk. And he was so furious, he vowed the boys should play no more. And some of the boys themselves were put in jail
for playing
for
being in a bad play.
For
play
being
like.
In a play he
you
didn't
could do
like.
That now with Mrs. Brown's boys, couldn't he? So you're you could go to prison.
The West End
actually
bin.
Go to prison.
Um, So, well, the thing is, though, it wouldn't be Mrs. Brown's Boys, would it? Because that's Main Street. The public love that, and that's fine. Oh, it would be some subversive little... It'd be the MASH report. It'd be Nish Kumar in prison.
Like cancelling the MASH report, as if they'd ever do that.
As if they'd ever do that. So that was that. Henry Evans, he'd officially left the company after the court case, but the fact was he still remained involved in all but name, and he continued to pay half the rent and receive half the profits. But in the summer of 1608, after the Boys' Theatre was essentially closed down by the king, he handed Blackfriars Theatre over to Shakespeare's King's Men.
Yes.
Who at this point opened it as a lovely indoor winter theatre space after freezing their knackers off every winter at the Globe.
Fantastic. And Shakespeare, who didn't do this thing, had apprentice boys acting as girls. Women still not allowed on stage for many, many, many years after this. I'm trying to think when women were allowed on stage.
I think after the Restoration, wasn't it? It was.
Was it that century?
I think it was.
Right. We should know this before we.
I should have researched. Yeah. I did theatre studies for A level. I remember learning all about when was like Nell Gwynn and.
That's Charles II. Yeah.
Charles II. So yeah. So that would have been. Yeah.
1660s. Yeah.
Yeah, late or mid 17th.
That's why the plague happened, Angela. That's why the plague and the Great Fire of London, because of the morals of Charles's restoration. God wreaked his vengeance.
It was God's retribution for women in the theatre, John. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
If you incur the wrath of God. So what happened to Thomas Clifton? Did he ever want to go back to... Did he like... Oh, you were that kid in that thing.
He had the life his father intended for him. He was a gentleman, a father, a lawyer in the heart of the city. Part of me does wonder, because we'll never know, like Thomas Clifton, whether he might have enjoyed theatre life, whether it was actually a life he wanted to be in and was taken away from, or whether
you're not doing drama at university, you're going to do more.
That's right, do something respectable where you can make an honest living.
You do like me, do drama and English, that's a little bit respectable. But no, you're doing law, Thomas, you're going to do the same job as your dad, and we're not going to the theatre, panto for you. Well, that was a very interesting tale, Angela. I'm shocked that kids were kidnapped for the theatre and that this was allowed and legal. You weren't too hard on my childhood acting performances, so thank you for being
I'll wait till we tweet out the pictures, John. I keep looking at it. They're almost like little lederhosen you're wearing.
I was also really in a thing called Jumbo Spencer. I was one of the bad boys in Jumbo Spencer. And that was like 6 weeks in Somerset when I was like 13 off school. A whole summer in Somerset. And that was great fun.
Wow.
On a BBC Children's TV thing. I really thought I was going to be an actor when I was a kid. And then that time with that one, it was on telly. And I saw myself. And I was like, I'm not sure I'm that good, really.
Oh, no. Oh. Yeah, but like, no child. It's very rare that you see a child actor and go, oh, they're good.
Yeah, yeah. I just sort of didn't even think about it, but it made me do drama at university, and maybe that's why I went into writing and entertainment. Who knows? But thank you, Red Roofs Theatre School, for encouraging me in my 10-year. Once a week, I went for 10 years from 8 to 18. Loved it. All boys' school, you see, Angela. So that's the only time I ever saw girls.
Oh yeah, of course. Well, this is it. So I did drama GCSE and A level because we did that with the boys' school.
Yeah.
So yeah,
so it was... shows you that the morals are still being corrupted by the theatre.
Oh, thank you for listening, everyone. Don't forget to watch From Beyond the Grave. I'm going to find it on YouTube and watch John and Diana Dawes in their horror film.
And Donald Pleasance, they're all in it.
And Donald, right, I'm definitely watching that. And don't forget to tweet us at We Are History Pod.
And give us good reviews, give us you bastards. 5 stars, please.
Yes. Thank you. And we'll see you next time.
We'll see you next week on We Are History. Thanks for listening.
Bye.